All right.
It's great to see you.
Hi.
I'm glad you could come. My first question to ask you is, what are you doing at Campus Tech? Are you presenting? You had a workshop yesterday. Are you doing a workshop?
Had a workshop yesterday on designing personal learning infrastructure.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
And I've given that one a number of times, and which is unusual for me because I don't usually repeat stuff, but
How
that
fun.
works. Because every context is different, every
Right.
audience is different, and
Right.
I'm different.
From time to
So,
time.
no, every talk I give, I'm a different person.
That's what I mean, over time.
Yeah, oh, okay. So, because I've read stuff, I've seen stuff,
Done stuff, yeah.
I've done stuff. So, I recreate the presentation over again. And my logic for that is, if I planned it ahead of time, I'd still be rewriting it. So I just write it fresh each time.
Wow.
I reuse
Excellent.
slides sometimes and things like that, but I try
Sure.
to change it up.
Oh, that's great and good for the audience.
I think so, yeah.
So that was the Personal Learning Networks. And are you doing anything this week as well?
I got a keynote tomorrow.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
So yeah, and that's, I forget the title. I never remember the
Well,
titles.
but since you're redoing it, what's the gist?
So I'm looking at the topic of innovation from the perspective of predicting the future, right? And that's why this particular this series is of interest to me too. And people have this idea that you can't predict the future, and of course that's not true. Can predict the future, but otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here together today.
Who made a schedule, I was able to predict that
Sure,
you would be here, and I had a certain degree of confidence that you would.
you have misplaced confidence, but
Oh, but it worked out. It worked out. But
it
then, that's true. We do have short-term predictions. We have scheduling. We have planning.
Oh, we have long-term predictions too. I mean, we know where the Earth will be in thousands of years. We pinpoint it precisely. So, I dare astrology to make predictions like
Oh, they do. They just you
that.
just can't test them.
So from that perspective, are we able to do that? And then look at the concept of innovation in that light. Because innovation, other people say, it's not just about having the idea, it's about executing the idea and about there being a benefit. And these things combined together with some understanding of how to predict the future give us a story about innovation and about what I'm going to want to talk about, transformation.
That's very different from Clayton Christensen.
Yeah, it is. I cite him. I talk about what he says a bit, but yeah, I want to go beyond Christensen. I think that the concept of innovation and even disruptive innovation, these are inherently conservative concepts. They're based on preserving what we have.
Also, literally conservative.
Literally conservative. Yeah, I'm not dealing with left-right politics here. No, I mean literally conservative. Literally, they deal with preserving what we have. And if you look at the innovation, some of the innovations that have taken place now, I'm known for talking about MOOCs and working in MOOCs and things like that. People look at MOOCs and what happened with MOOCs, and ultimately it ended up being a conservative phenomenon. The big innovation was make online learning a lot like traditional
And now you're seeing that with closed MOOCs and open
learning.
MOOCs and
The oxymoron called closed
That's right. That's
MOOCs.
right.
The oxymoron called for-pay MOOCs. So, yeah.
So, looking ahead, what are some of the changes that you anticipate happening in higher education? And now you're based in Canada, and one of the things that I love about your work is you're one of the few people who is actually transnational in thinking. I mean, you pay careful attention to national differences, national nuances, but you actually pay attention to countries other than Canada, other than the United States. I mean, what are some of the big forces you're seeing, some of the big changes?
Well, I mean, open online learning is huge. It's a lot more huge than people give it credit for. And people are talking about, this MOOCs have peaked, it's the end of MOOCs, MOOCs are so over. And yet there's this ongoing huge demand for open online learning. I like to say, more people took a MOOC last year, 2015, than in all previous years combined. It's not a phenomenon that's over.
No, quite the opposite.
Yeah. So I think that's really important. There's a lot of talk, especially in corporate learning, but it bleeds over into academia as well, about competencies. What's the
Competence-based
word?
learning?
Competency-based learning. Yeah, but there was
Yeah.
a phrase that was used this morning during the keynote. I'm trying to remember what mastery learning or something
Yes,
like
mastery
that.
learning from Bloom. Yeah.
And recognition for learning, micro recognition badges, things like that, and of course leading us to quote unquote personalized learning. I think this is going to be a very temporary phase in learning. And the reason why I think it's going to be very temporary is because it's so unnecessary.
Why?
We're not actually solving the real problem that people have when they're going after learning. The real problem people have isn't, gee, I need to be recognized for this. I know it's represented that way a lot, but the real problem people have is, well, it's one of two things. There's probably many things, but I'll caricature it, right? It's one of two things, right? First of all, they need to know something in order to get something done. And that characterizes the vast 80% area known as informal learning, right? So you don't need a credit for that. You just need to get done what you're going to get done.
Oh, 'cause it's instrumental.
It's
Oh,
instrumental,
okay.
right? So badges aren't solving any problem there, right? Because,
I see what you mean.
so the other side, right, the formal learning,
Okay.
the reason why they need recognition is so that the learning that they've achieved, and we can talk about what that means, but the learning they've achieved opens doors for them, specifically gives them employment opportunities, perhaps advancement to, well, since a lot of this achievement going to be available through digital records, through open digital records, a person's life will, in a sense, be, I don't want to say an open book because it'll be based on permissions and all of that, but
True, true.
available, right?
Okay.
So why give them a credential? Just offer them a job, right? So your, I like to say it in slogan form, your achievement in learning will be recognized not by a diploma, but by a job offer.
This sounds a bit like David Weinberger's observation about using data instead of metadata to make a decision.
Exactly.
So if I want to figure out should I hire this Stephen Downs character, I can go through your blog, I can go through whatever you present to us, whatever you don't present to us, I can explore. And that will be ultimately more useful to me from an HR perspective than it would be just looking at your credentials.
Well, exactly. In fact, the credentials are probably misleading. The credentials will tell you I'm a master's in philosophy, period, end of story.
And that doesn't tell me very much.
Not very much, and it's like I say, it's misleading. It's not inaccurate. I do have a master's in philosophy. I have deep knowledge of the subject. But I think I bring more to the table.
Well, so if the major need for education, formal and informal, is instrumental, so I want to learn Python so I can make program, I want to learn how to dig gardens so I can eat, and then we have the smaller use, which is credentialed. And it was and is credentialed, but you think in the future it won't be credentialed. Was there a third category, or is that the
No,
main two?
that's the lot.
So I can
Unless
see.
you can think of one. I mean, I'm always open to these
I was thinking
things.
of subdivisions of these, basically. So this is the two categories stand. Do you think then that we would see a shift towards campuses producing more ways of sharing data? So moving towards more e-portfolios, for example, domain of one's own, in order to get students producing more open content.
That's a hard question because it speaks to intentions, right? What do they want to do? Now, if campuses behave like typical businesses, which many of them are, not all of them, but many of them are, then what they will do is desperately cling to their existing market share, which means they're not going to share data. Right. They'll desperately cling to their existing business model. They will seek out quote unquote innovation
Right.
to bring us back, because I like to tie things together. But this innovation will be deeply conservative and continue to preserve the idea that what you need in your education is to be found exclusively on the university campus. What the internet teaches us is that this is increasingly false. So I think, people say, well, everybody predicted the collapse of the university system and look how wrong they were. They were saying that about newspapers 5 years ago. Everybody predicted the collapse of newspapers and look how wrong they were, because everybody's still reading them.
They're doing badly. I mean, the only form of journalism that is doing well financially is TV news, for which I think we should be embarrassed for all time.
You really should be, and even that, with the exodus from cable to streaming media, cable news might be reaching its best before date as well.
Oh, I think it's starting to stink.
Yeah, well, it's turned, definitely.
It's right. I want to pursue this, but we have a question from Abram.
No
And
questions, just kidding.
so if we could bring Abram up on stage.
This is the
Hello.
camera.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
I really want to thank you. I've followed your work for a while, and it's really been helpful to me. My question is, I'm thinking about new tools like the Slack team communication platform really offers an opportunity in the workplace for greater connectivity, diversity, knowledge sharing. But I think people are also rightly worried about managing their attention and becoming overwhelmed by too many different feeds. This is something that comes up a lot with MOOCs. I'd just love to hear a few thoughts from you on the topic.
So yeah, and I'm familiar with Slack. We've used Slack internally. It's a nice system. Again, I prefer things that are way more distributed, but you take what you can get. The very idea of distributed knowledge sources leads to that sort of question: how are you going to manage all of this stuff? And the short answer is we're going to use tools that will help us do that a lot. And it's also the answer to the question Brian didn't ask, which was, how do we use actual evidence as opposed to certificates in order to understand a person's achievements when it takes, hours to go through somebody's evidence? So we use analytics, we use artificial intelligence, and we use specifically systems that are designed to, and I use the word very precisely, nice, what it is I'm looking for. And these system, I mean, and I want to be clear that I'm talking about going beyond the sort of recommender systems that we have in Netflix or things like that.
I
You watch
understand.
one Western on Netflix and they're pitching like John Wayne to you for the rest of your life. Not good. We're looking at much more sophisticated systems. Again, systems that use the broad scope of your interactions with others, other social media, other people, other sites, in order to understand your needs and your preferences. A lot of the existing recommender systems are based on a very narrow evidence base. Netflix really only has evidence about what movies you watch on Netflix. They don't even look at other services. Just craziness. So I think it's going to be a personal kind of analytics. It'll have to be a personal kind of analytics, grabbing a vast swath of your data, running it through a graph-based, network-based kind of analysis in order to, and then you present it with, the full range of evidence that's in front of you, all the possible things that you might be interested in looking at, or all the possible candidates for a specific position or whatever, right? I mean, there's different scenarios. And it pulls out a subset of those as being most likely.
And then as you repeat this, the system learns and gets better and better at this.
That's right. And just as a caution, this does not mean, I never know how to pronounce this word, homophily or homophily. It doesn't
Either way.
mean you're going to be narrowing in through and getting a filter bubble of only the stuff that already meets.
How do you avoid that?
You avoid that
Intentional
by,
design?
well, no, I don't like intentional design because it's so often wrong. I mean, the way a tool reacts is based on how a person uses the tool, right? So if all you ever watch are Westerns, then the system's going to recommend Westerns to you. If you watch a reasonably diverse array of movies, I'm just using movies as an example, but then the system is going to be pulling in a much broader array of categories. But even more to the point, a neural network system specifically isn't going to be category based. It isn't going to be taxonomy based. It's going to be pulling cues, which are subcategorical, technically even subsymbolic. So you don't know you're looking for things of that type, but it'll see something. So, I'm watching all my movies. It'll see something in a modern romance, which I wouldn't typically click on, and it says, oh, and you can't even put a finger on, what that thing is, but it recognizes this romance fits well enough and presents it to
If I can shift the analogy a bit, that sounds a
you.
bit more like Pandora, which isn't looking at recommendations of, okay, you're listening to smooth jazz for hard rock, but it's actually looking at instrumentation, time signature, length of song.
But again, and that's a good point. But again, these are predefined categories, right? If you go beyond that, you go beyond predefined categories, then it's looking for things you can't even name.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So yeah, we'll be pretty. I mean, I think we'll find these systems. They're very similar to, well, human perceptual mechanisms.
Sure.
So they're responding to what's out there the way you would respond looking at, for those of us who are old enough, looking at the selection of videos in the video store, right?
Right.
And it's like,
Or
oh, yeah, maybe.
A good librarian or a good bookseller. You can say, well, I'm interested in a new book. And they can look at you, and the more they know about you, and some of those cues will be, subvocal. Abram, that was a terrific question with a lot of depth to it. Thank you. If I can turn that question back to something earlier, and then I want to bring you in a second, Scott. You mentioned yesterday working on the personal learning network or personal learning environment. To what ex How do you see analytics and artificial intelligence playing a role?
Well, there's a bunch of different things they can do, right? Various slides for presentations I've done, I've broken it down a bit. There's one type of task is a categorization task. So you're looking at a selection of stuff, whatever it is, and you organize it into clusters, whatever they are. That's the kind of task that'll do that automatic grading systems do, right? You're looking at a bunch of student essays. It classifies them into A's, B's, C's, and D's, right? Based on well, essentially feature detection. So that's one thing. What would you use that for? I don't know, there's all kinds of uses for that. You've got again your all of your stuff coming in from the world, thousands of sources every day. It'll give you a list of genres that you can pick from. They're
Nice.
not predefined genres, but
No, yeah, that's good.
so any categorization task actually has two parts to it. Number one, you divide the categories, so that's easy.
Right.
Number two, you name them. That's hard.
It's powerful.
Naming it, but that's the only way you're going to be able to select from genres, right? Is if they have names. So it'll find the categories and name them for you.
Well, I understand your criticism of Netflix, but I have to, in their defense, say they do one thing that provides entertainment for me, which is ever more refined subcategories. So, for instance, it becomes occult westerns, and then it becomes dark westerns with a cerebral hero, and then and those become ludicrous over time, but very entertaining.
Yeah, one of my favorite categories, movies with a strong female lead. That's a category. That's
Well,
great.
it has to be. It has to be.
Yeah.
And that's a mid-range category, I would say.
Yeah,
You,
yeah.
you need movies with a strong female lead that are science fiction and involve paranoid themes from the 1970s, right?
Yeah.
Well,
now we're getting.
Well, let me ask. I mean, that sounds like a very, very powerful tool. That sounds like a fantastic way to work. And I say this as someone who spends a lot of time in a bunch of categories. I have lots and lots of Twitter columns, and I have many, many
sure,
RSS feeds
yeah.
broken out. I'm wondering what.
Saw you reading Twitter there while we were talking.
Yes, I had to. That's where I got some of these questions from. I'm wondering, Scott, what does gaming add to someone's personal learning environment? What does it do for their personal learning network? I mean, just to see this a little bit, I'm a very big fan of Duolingo, which is a language learning app, which is very gamified. And I've started learning Spanish because I shamefully don't have it, so I've been learning it. And I find that really changes my approach to the language and learning. That's one little example. I mean, what are you imagining going forward for gaming and personal learning environment?
Well, I guess with Duolingo, like some of the things that gaming really helps with education is just getting that instant feedback on what you're doing. You know, I love in that app the sound design of it, actually.
Yeah.
That was the first thing I realized that was really impressive was the sound design of Duolingo.
What do you like about them? That's just so crisp and clear, or?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's almost like Mario or Sonic or any other, but just when you pronounce something correctly, when you do something correctly, it gives the little chime. And
right.
I think it even has a slight buzzer sound when you get it wrong. So. Yeah.
But no electric shock or anything. That's good.
No, not at this point. They might have an attachment or something at some point.
Okay, so this helps you as an individual learner.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any connection between an individual gaming, in a sense, or playing a game or a gamified learning object, and the rest of learning, the rest of social learning or other objects in the world?
Well, games in general, any game, games at heart are about learning. I mean, when you're interacting with a game, any kind of game system, you're learning how to use that game. It's really the same thing. And sometimes we have a very convoluted class that's really just a very convoluted game in the
mm-hmm.
same way. You're
mm-hmm.
trying to get from point
sure.
A to point B the same way you are in a game. So.
Yeah. You know, I often think that flying air travel in the U.S. is the world's worst multiplayer game. You know,
yeah.
So you have points, you have levels, it's clearly artificial, it's clearly badly done, you know, barely shambles along. But, you know, that's a metaphor, but I do have to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, my children are learning how to fly now, and I feel apologetic to them for this, but they have to learn where things are. And your example of the campus, they learn where the bursar is, they have to learn how to work with agents and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So gaming is learning. I mean, maybe between the two of you gentlemen, we have this synthesis of rethinking personal learning networks as a gamified experience, either explicitly with having points and values and levels, or at least simply bringing game design principles to PLNs and PLEs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say? What do you say?
Well, I am thinking about that. I mean, first of all, I love games.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spent way too many of my hours online gaming. If I was gaming, it brought me into the field in the first place. It's multi-user dungeons.
Oh, sure.
So I used to play them, then I used
yeah.
to code them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, loved those.
Yeah, I taught a class in one in the 90s.
Yeah. I didn't teach a class properly, so-called, in one. We held a conference in one in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
95, in fact, for the Canadian Association of Distance Education. That'll be my phone ringing. that was well done. But.
And there's a big but here.
Yeah. With respect to learning, maybe you can go in two directions. You can go in the direction of games, or you can go in the direction of real life, right? With a very similar kind of environment. And you talk about airlines, which is, you know, real life. It feels pretty artificial sometimes when
right,
it's like real life.
Right.
And I think that education's future is probably more in the area of real life than it is in the area of gamification. And I'm being precise here. I mean gamification as opposed to serious games. So, because we have a gamification system in real life, it's called money, right? And money is your point system. I'm looking forward to the day, and maybe we will have, that'll be my message now. I'm looking forward to the day when we have alternative gamification systems in real life, raising enough game points,
Oh, yeah.
financial
Let's call her
points.
Doctor as a Wuffy.
Ruffy, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know about Cory Doctorow's Ruffy, but that's okay.
That's a popular name.
I don't read Doctorow. I don't. He doesn't appeal to me. I know he appeals to a lot of people.
Yeah, we can talk about this afterwards, but
Yeah. Well, and there's it's nothing specific. It's just a thing.
To come back to your point, you think that
It's
in
like Neil Gaiman, right? There's celebrity, sort of
well,
internet celebrity,
for
and then
Gaiman,
there's
you have to read the comics. That's the best thing. But but for alternate things, we used to have a few alternate, a few gamified parts of our society that we no longer have as mainstream. So if you think of the Western culture, we had religion in a certain way where that would be very public. You'd have certain coin that you would trade, and that would be a major way of determining life. And that's true right
You
now.
still
That's
have that here. I mean, there's a chapel
Well, no,
outside.
but it's not something that's it's explicit. It's something you
Yeah,
think
yeah,
about,
yeah.
at a conference.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have to ask, are you sinning today, or or
Yeah.
which subgroup of Christianity do you belong to? We can, but
You think
so.
of the code of the West, right? The code of the West, you had not just your wealth, but you had your honor, right? And people valued their honor more than they valued their wealth.
There's
I can't wait till we get away from wealth as being the only game in town.
Well, the Star Trek points the way, I think, in that way, as does Ian Banks in the Culture series. So it may be that to come back to learning, though, I mean, there's two different ways forward then, which may be parallel. One is increased gamification, gaming, and the other is turning pedagogy into real life, and more actual practical work. I want to, if we have time, I want to pursue that. But we have a question from Sandro Montiero. If I mispronounce your name, please forgive me. Sandro asks, if a shift in recognizing competence indeed happens from credentials to what you can really do, back to real life, what should change in education and higher ed? That's a big question.
Oh, what should change? Again, it's like that, the quote from Buckminster Fuller, in this morning's keynote.
Trim tab.
It wasn't about the trim tab specifically, but it was the idea that you change a system not by fighting it, but by making it irrelevant. And so, the questions like what should change in higher education always presuppose that the change is going to happen within the system. And I really doubt that. In fact, I so doubt that. It's like that. It's like trying to reform Fox News from within the newsroom, and it's not going to happen. It's gonna happen outside Fox News. It's gonna happen by something else being more worth watching than that.
That's a market
Whatever it
solution in
is.
a way.
Well, it's a market solution in a way. I mean, we could have a talk about market solutions because, what call a market is really a very controlled and managed environment. It's
Quite
not a
true.
market at all.
And it is a game.
And, well, it's gamified.
Yes, yes.
It's not a game, it's real life. But it is gamified, and as a
I can
result, and
accept
this
that.
is as a result of it being gamified, people pursue really inappropriate ends within the market. Inappropriate as in ends that are destructive to the market as a whole, with the result that, for example, most of the world's wealth is stashed away in overseas bank accounts, and there's more money out there than there is stuff to buy in this money that's stashed away was ever released, we would destroy our economic system. But that's all aside.
That's a different game.
That's a different game. But, you know, so what will change in the educational system? Probably nothing. They will hold on until the very end. There will be professors on stage saying, you know, I am not going to use a whiteboard. Real math is done on a chalkboard. And they'll retire that way. You know, I mean, this is the other Kuhnian point when you talk about paradigm shifts, right? One paradigm replaces the other, not through changing minds, but through the death of the people who live right. in the old paradigm.
I call this the Soviet model of change.
Soviet model, yeah. Well, the Soviet model is an accelerated model of that.
Well, it did take 30 years for it to happen. But, yes. And this is the end yeah. of Fox News. The median viewer of Fox News is something like 69 or 70 years old.
Yeah, yeah, this is how it ends.
So about 15 years to go or so.
And then it's done. It's also the case for newspapers, and it's also the case for the university system.
How? I was waiting for that climax. I'm conscious of time, folks. We are at the end of our hour, but we have one question from the excellent Kisa Johnson. Can we bring Kisa up on stage? And Kisa, where are you today?
I am working from home today. I am working
Oh, great.
From home. I'm in Michigan. I'm in East Lansing. Yeah.
Well, that's okay.
Oh, can you guys hear me? Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So here's my question. Oh, it was great. I'm gonna have to listen to more of the beginning. But here's my question, especially to Stephen, and I like the other panelists to answer as well. I've been really trying to dig. Like, I don't know. My spirit has been following me in the theory of emergence right now, and I really wanted to know. Like, could you give me some type of insight when it comes to that theory of emergence and how that fit into online learning?
And how that fits into online learning. So that's it's a terrific question. It's also one that'll take 4 or 5 hours to answer. But okay.
Talk offline.
So, yeah. So let's deal first of all what is emergence, right? Emergence is a phenomenon that can be seen in a larger collection of things, typically a network of things, that is not present in the individual entities of that thing. So the example I use a lot is a picture of Richard Nixon on a television screen. Right. So the television screen, I know, is not standard, but it's close enough. So the television screen of a whole bunch of little pixels. All right. None of those little pixels is an image of Richard Nixon, right? But the way those pictures are organized on the screen results in there being an image of Richard Nixon on the screen. So we can say a little loosely, right, but we can say the image of Richard Nixon is an emergent property of the pixels. We can say it that way, right? And technically there are some inaccuracies, but it's close enough that I can use that to make the point.
Okay.
So, okay. What does that have to do with learning? So one of the theories of connectivism, theses of connectivism, is that knowledge is the organization of a network of entities, like, for example, neurons in the brain, mm-hmm. or like, for example, people and artifacts in a society,
right?
Mm-hmm. Or other networks. But these two are the important ones that I'll talk about for now. So we have a network in society and a network of neurons in the brain. So let's take just the brain for now. So we have a bunch of neurons. They're kind of like pixels, but they're not, right? But they're kind of like pixels. And our thought that, say, Paris is the capital of France is not contained in any one of those individual neurons, because a neuron can't do that. Neurons are really stupid. They can go da 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 da, da and that's it,
right.
Right? But you take enough neurons in a network together, And emergent from that is the piece of knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. Social networks work the same way. So you have a bunch of people and a bunch of artifacts, and they're all connected together. You have individual people. They may have ideas like Paris is the capital of France or whatever, but the knowledge of a society isn't simply Paris is the capital of France, but it's a much, it's emergent from all of those individuals. So an example I use is the knowledge of how to fly a 747 from New York to Paris. Mm-hmm. No person mm-hmm. in society has that knowledge. Nobody. Right, because think about what you have to know. You have to know how to make tires. You have to know how to make airline windows. You have to know how to take off the plane, fly it, and hopefully land it. You have to know how to serve coffee during turbulence. You have to be able to navigate it, etc. I could go on and on and on. No person has that knowledge. So that piece of knowledge is emergent from society.